the deterministic laws of classical physics hold to an excellent approximation. This quasi-classical realm, as we like to call it, is certainly an immediate fact of everyday experience, and we use it all the time. And yet we know about the universe suggests that the quasi-classical realm isn't something that just happens here or in a few places chosen by human observers, but it exists over the entirety of the spatial volume of the universe and from the Planck time in the beginning all the way to the indefinite future. If we equip ourselves for a journey to a distant galaxy, we don't think that we have to take along interferometers sensitive to some highly complex interference that might be the rule of the land there. The usual quasi-classical realms and our method of observing them will work just as well there as here. Now, when I say that the quasi-classical realm is a remarkable feature of the universe, is because what we know of the basic laws of physics suggests that we live in a quantum mechanical universe characterized by indeterminacy, distributed probability, and uncertainty, a world where the classical laws can be but approximations to the universe, unitary evolution of the Schrödinger equation, and to the reduction of the wave packet. So it's this quasi-classical, so manifest, right, was this quasi-classical realm to us that the Copenhagen quantum mechanics just assumed it, simply posited, right, as a feature of that way of formulating quantum mechanics. In Copenhagen quantum mechanics, there was a kind of two separate physics, right, one a classical one and the other a quantum mechanical one with a kind of movable boundary in between them. Classical physics was the realm of observers, measurements, apparatus, outcomes, and so forth. And quantum physics was the realm of electrons, protons, atoms, and the nuclei, which were being measured and probed in experimental situations. Now, it was cosmology, I think, that forced a generalization of this quantum mechanical framework. And certainly it was Everett who started this on the one root to one. And that's because in cosmology, in a theory of the universe, there can't be any fundamental division into two kinds of physics. In a theory which seeks to describe the very early universe, there can't be any fundamental role played by measurements and observers because none exists there. And in general, in quantum mechanics, there are no variables that behave classically in all circumstances. So for this reason, usual Copenhagen quantum mechanics has to be generalized to apply to cosmology. And today, we have an adequate generalization, at least in a fixed background spacetime, in the consistent or decoherent histories formulation of quantum mechanics, most generally the universe. This is the work of a great many people, of which I've only listed a small number down here at the bottom. And it's based, I think, squarely on the Everettian idea that we take quantum mechanics seriously for the closed system containing both observers and observed, measured and measuring, and everything else, indeed. Certainly, the decoherent histories formulation can be viewed as an extension and, to some extent, in completion of the program Everett launched, right, in the quantum mechanics of cosmology. And as far as I know, it's the only framework that we have today that is adequate for cosmology and consistent with the rest of modern physics, such as special relativity, field theory, and quantum spacetime. It would be a great interest to have alternatives to decoherent histories, because as far as I know, it was not engraved on the backside of the Tablet of Moses. We have limited data in cosmology, certainly in quantum cosmology. And just to motivate experiment, it would be very interesting to have alternatives to the theory to motivate tests. There may be candidates for these on the horizon, but at the moment we don't have one. It's quite a striking feature of this subject, which is quantum mechanics, which is 80 years old, which after all has been tested only in a very limited microscopic realm. You would think there would be many more theories that agree on the microscopic realm and disagree on the macroscopic one. But as Weinberg said, it just turns out to be very difficult to find a theory which is slightly different from quantum mechanics that's not quantum mechanics itself. But I emphasize the problem. I'm not going to try to review decoherent histories here, except incidentally, right, to a discussion of classicality. But basically, the idea is this. The closed system, which is the universe, has an initial quantum state and a Hamiltonian, perhaps Hawking's wave function of the universe for the state and M-theory for the Hamiltonian. And what's predicted from, what you can predict from these is the probabilities for any set of histories that is decoherent, that is for which there is negligible quantum interference between the individual histories in a set of alternative histories. Thus, probabilities are predicted in decoherent histories for the position of the moon when nobody is looking at it, or was looking at it, and for density fluctuations in the early universe when there are no observers around to carry out any measurements on it. Sometimes people, I was asked by the organizers to address this particular question, which seems to me to be so reasonably evident, you know, why histories at all? As far as I know, every single physical theory that operates below the Planck scale has had a notion of histories and things evolving in time. The question should be rather, can we get away with not having histories in quantum mechanics? To me, it would be very surprising if all these years we had histories and then suddenly they vanished. So I'm going to assume them. You certainly need them. After all, what is the enterprise in cosmology? Mostly we reconstruct the past. Why do we do that? It's over and done with. The answer is it's easier to put in assumptions. The data is so limited, it's easier to put in assumptions in the past than it is in the future. And so when we construct simple models, it's easier to explain things now, why things are as they are, by explaining why things were as they were. So histories are necessary to do that, to reconstruct the past. So they're essential for cosmology. You need them to define classicality, which is the subject of this talk. Because what does it mean for something to behave classically? It means its orbit obeys a classical equation of motion that exhibits correlations in time, right, that are defined by deterministic equations of motion. You need it just to define what a record is. Sometimes people say, well, we could do it all in terms of record. But a record is something now which is correlated with some event in the past. That's a history. We need it to understand just how we work, right, as human beings, since we don't operate on scales of the Planck scale and many psychological problem phenomena that occur over time. And we need it, of course, to predict the future. OK, that's my duty to the organizers here. That's my histories. I want to come back to the quasi-classical realm. But a formalism like this one, decoherent histories that does not posit the quasi-classical realm, has to explain it, because it's a feature of the universe that's observed. So it has to explain it as a feature of our specific universe from its particular quantum initial condition and its dynamics. It's this I will talk about today. And it's going to be a different kind of talk, I think, from what's going on before, in that I don't see any controversial elements in it. Calculations may be wrong, but I don't think there's anything really to debate, right, in that sense. I'm going to posit the probability rule, right, and not derive it, right? I'm going to assume we have this framework, and I'm going to try where's the evidence? How do we get out this information about the quasi-classical realm from in specific situations? It'll be mostly about calculations, which may not be of interest to the philosophers, but are of vital interest to physicists. Now, if you open any quantum mechanics book, you will see right away some sort of derivation of classical behavior. A typical one is the Ehrenfest derivation of classical equations of motion. There's Ehrenfest's theorem, which tells us that the acceleration of an expected value of position is equal to the expected value of the force. That's not an equation of motion by itself. But for typical states, typically very narrow wave packets, it becomes an equation of motion for the expectation value, because you can replace this by the derivative of the potential evaluated at the expected value if the wave packet is very narrow. What that says is that the expected value in such states moves on a classical trajectory. More precisely, it says if you carry out a series of measurements of position over time with sufficient imprecision that you don't disturb the approximation that allowed you to replace that by this, then those measurements will be correlated in time by that classical equation of motion by Newton's laws. But the Ehrenfest derivation is completely inadequate for the kind of derivation that we want in cosmology. First of all, it's limited to expectation values. But classical behavior is most properly defined by probabilities for histories, right? For example, if we're interested in the probability of the orbit of the Earth around the sun, it might take any orbit in quantum mechanics. The assertion that it moves on a classical nice Keplerian ellipse is the assertion that for certain types of coarse grainings and certain types of states, that the probability is high for this orbit as distinct from all the other possible orbits. So we need the probabilities of histories, not expectation values, to define the classicality. The Ehrenfest theorem deals with measurements on isolated subsystems that have a few degrees of freedom that we choose. But we're interested in classical behavior, as I mentioned, over the entirety of the visible universe, not just at a few times and places chosen by human IGOSes, but over the whole thing, from the Planck time to the distant future, and in as maximally refined a description as possible, so that it becomes a feature of the universe and not and the universe's Hamiltonian initial state. In short, it becomes a fact, or a thing, right, that is independent of whether it exists independently of whether it's receiving the attention of human observers. The Ehrenfest theorem relies on a close connection between the equations of the fundamental action and the classical equations which describe classical behavior. But if you think about it in a fundamental theory, these may be very different. When we speak of classical behavior of the moon, or even water in a pipe, and certainly if we're talking about heterotic superstring theory, the classical equations of motion may be only distantly related to the ones in the fundamental theory, and we have to be able to accommodate them. The Ehrenfest theorem posits some variable x in which we are going to examine for classical behavior. But we're interested not in choosing the variable, but in deriving it, or at least giving an argument for it in which classicality is expressed, or those variables in which it is expressed. Finally, the Ehrenfest theorem assumes a fixed classical spacetime. But in physics, after all, the geometry of the universe is itself obeys a classical law. And we're interested in deriving that from quantum gravity. So for these reasons, the Ehrenfest investigation is inadequate, and we have to do something better. However, there are two things that are characteristic of this that we can take away from the Ehrenfest derivation. Is you need two things. You need some coarse graining of a particular kind to define classical behavior, some imprecision, and you need some restriction on the state. And I'll try to describe what these are more generally. So I'm now going to describe a series of models for you, gradually working up to more and more things that satisfy the remedy the difficulties with this Ehrenfest derivation. To do that, just to review the schematics of decoherent histories very quickly, the input to decoherent histories are some dynamics that are expressed by an action S, an initial state psi. Some prescription for what the set of all completely fine-grained histories are, which in this case I'll take for particles to be the set of all Feynman paths, just x as a function of t, and in field theory for all four-dimensional configurations for fields. And then sets of coarse-grained histories, which are partitions of these fine-grained histories into classes, which each class being the coarse-grained history itself, and they're represented by operators which you can either think of as being sequences of projections down on, for example, ranges of position The particle went through one range at this time, another range at a later time, another range at a later time. Or you can think of it in a sum over histories formulation, which is what I'll chiefly be using, as a sum of Feynman's e to the I action over all the histories that lie in a particularly fine-grained histories that lie in a particular coarse-grained class. The decoherence functional is the measure of interference between histories, which is defined in this way usually as this bilinear product in the initial state. This is pure, I use the rho here. And probabilities are predicted when the probabilities for alpha are predicted for when these sets that decohere, they're just the diagonal elements of the decoherence functional. Okay, any questions about that? I'm doing that
for simplicity.
Yeah. Right.
And
so we do that in principle because of the way it's in position one.
Exactly. Right. And further, you don't have to just consider that it's worse than that. You consider sums of all these in classes. But I'm going to have a bunch of trouble getting through. I need to make it through sheets.
Yeah, good question. Mm-hmm. How much choice is there in the selection of the decoherence function?
Or what space are we choosing?
What do you mean? You want something to generate probabilities, but this is it's just a functional you define.
All right, so I'm positing all this.
Right, and I'm just wondering, is any, you know, there is physics built in.
There's a whole hierarchy of coherence conditions, ranging from none, right, to what's called linear positivity, to weak decoherence, to medium decoherence, to strong decoherence. This is medium decoherence. It seems to us physically realistic. It's what you get when, for example, in Max's example of the Olsen set, when the photons carry multiple of the bases, this is what's true. Just a word about the terminology for this talk. Decoherence means the absence of interference between histories, not what Wojtek means, which is the diagonalization of a density matrix. The two are very closely related, but I don't have time to explain to you why that's true. And I think consistent is a better word for what I'm using, but for historical reason and to keep my famous collaborator happy, I continue to use decoherence. I mean, decoherent. Griffiths was first, there's no doubt about that. Okay, so I'm now going to talk about this in the famous oscillator models pioneered by Feynman and Vernon, by Caldera and Leggett, by Unruh and Zurek, by Gell-Mann, many, many others have worked on this. Then, my little system we're going to use for illustrative purposes are non-relativistic particles with coordinates q, which can be divided into two coordinates. We can think of x as one particular oscillator, and q, which is a bath, capital Q, which is a bath of a whole lot of other oscillators which are interacting with it. So there's one distinguished oscillator, which has mass m and frequency omega, and it's linearly coupled to a bath of these other operators. So the Hamiltonian is just the coordinate of the oscillator times the coordinate of one of the bath particles multiplied by some coupling constant, which is proportional to its constant gamma. For the dynamics, we have a free action for the oscillator, a free action for the bath of oscillators, and this linear interaction. For the initial state, I'm going to assume a product state between the distinguished oscillator, which I'm going to follow in the coarse grading, and a thermal bath for all the other oscillators characterized by a temperature T. For coarse graining, I'm just going to follow X, meaning a coarse grained history as this could be described, for example, by taking a series of three times, plotting X out this way, and then asking whether X went through this particular region at that time, that particular region at that time, and that particular region at that time. For a sequence of intervals at times t1 through tn, which gives a history telling us which intervals the particle went through at those times. Now, why did we do all that? Because it makes the integrals easy to do, right? The thermal bath for oscillators, e to the minus beta h, that's quadratic in the q's. This is quadratic in the x's and q's. And we can all do Gaussian integrals. Here's the result. The result for the decoherence functional, which is, remember, this trace, that can be rewritten in a sum over histories form.
Here is the initial density matrix, which is this is still completely general, not separating the two kinds of oscillators. There's E to the IS, which is essentially the dynamics for one of the histories on one side of the decoherence functional, and another E to the opposite IS for the one on the other. And in the end, they have to wind up we have to integrate over the same final state, that's the trace. So roughly speaking, this is that, and that is that. And the reason the alphas match is because we're only integrating over histories which are in the class alpha, that is, thread those regions on one side, and over the class alpha prime, thread the regions on the other side. Now, since only X is restricted and the environment is quadratic, you can carry out the integrals over the cubes. When you're finished, you get something that's not an integral over the little q's, but an integral just over the x's, over the free action, which is all that's left, and what's called, and something else, which is called the Feynman-Vernon influence phase, which is the result of doing all those integrals. Any questions about this?
So here's the answer.
In the high temperature Fokker-Planck limit, right? The influence phase has an imaginary part. That comes from the bath, which is not e to the I something, but e to the minus beta h, right? And it looks like this. It's got this coefficient. This is the mass of the particle, the coupling to the bath. That's Boltzmann's constant, the temperature divided by h bar. And it's proportional to the integral over time. It's local in time, which is the advantage of the high temperature limit. And it's proportional to this difference between the x's. So remember, we're evaluating a decoherence function. There's one set of histories, coarse grain histories on this side, another on the other, right? And this is what we get for the W, the imaginary part of the W, which is, you can see, since there's an I out here, is going to cause damping. This squeezes, therefore, this factor is highest when x prime and x are close to each other. So it effectively squeezes the two trajectories together. That's the only non-vanishing contribution. That's decoherence, the decoherence functional becoming diagonal. And it occurs on this characteristic kind. You have to build up enough action in this integral over time in order to get significant squeezing. The time scale for that is the decoherence time first discussed by Wojtek, I believe, right? Which is just the inverse of this h bar over 2m gamma pb times delta squared.
I'm not sure if I understand what you mean when you say this squeezes x prime of t and x of t together.
We have an integral here over x and x prime. When I put this up in the exponent here, this will be e to the minus something times x minus x prime. Mm-hmm. So the double integral, if you think of doing an integral in two dimensions, this is x and this is x prime, only have a significant contribution.
Yeah. In other words, it's suppressing the terms where x prime and x prime.
Correct. So I didn't mean squeezing like there's a force between them. Effectively squeezing. The only non-negligible contribution comes from when alpha is equal to alpha prime. This means we're the same if we have that time scale. Notice that the bigger the coupling, right, the faster the decoherence. The higher the temperature, the faster the decoherence. The more coarse grain you have, the bigger delta, the faster you get decoherence. Now, in this approximation, right, in which we assume these are diagonal, we can calculate the integral of the rest I'm constrained by, which means we get the following expression for the probabilities. The probabilities are given by the integral dx times something, which I'm not going to bother you with, times e to the minus this factor, times the same factor we have on the other transparency, but upside down. Times e squared, where e is the equation of motion, including the inevitable damping that arises from the coupling to the back. That's a prediction of classicality, because this is e to the minus this. It strongly peaks when the equation of motion is satisfied, when this is zero. That's prediction of classical correlations in time.
But it's not exactly true, right? Because this distribution has a width, which is governed by this factor right here. And the width of the distribution represents the quantum and thermal noise that arise from the coupling to the vast. So classicality is not exact, of course. It comes, there is a certain stochastic element. Now, when do we get things which are predicted? Here's the same two slides. Here was the expression for decoherence. And here's the expression for the equations of motion with the noise. Notice that the that these are upside down, related to one another, and that's intuitively true because the more noise you have, the bigger the deviations from classicality and the less predictability. So if you do increase the, and in fact, the fact that these occur like this is basically just the fluctuation dissipation theory. So the bigger gamma, you want to make more decoherence, you also increase the noise. Then you make this distribution wider. The solution to that problem to get predictability and fast decoherence is not only to do that, but to increase the inertia of the system. So to make that the master. So classical prediction occurs for variables that have the inertia to resist, to keep on being predictable in the face of the noise, the typical mechanisms of decoherence produce. So where are we on the Ehrenfest scorecard? Well, this model is certainly talking about the probabilities of histories. So it gets a gold star there. It's talking about not just isolated subsystems, but a whole closed model subsystem. It's a pretty simple model, so it gets a gold star there. But it still does relies on a connection between the equations of motion and the fundamental action of classical variables. A black star there. Turns out Kino didn't have an X. And it certainly posits the variable we're going to look at the classical behavior in. We just said we're going to follow this, and it certainly had nothing to do with classical spacetime. So we want to find out what are the variables that generally define coarse grain histories that exhibit classical correlations in time. Governed, I emphasize, it's not just a matter that they're predictable, but they obey closed systems of classical equations of motion. The key to that is the story about equilibrium and local equilibrium. Suppose we have a closed system of particles in a non-rotating box. After a long time, the box will approach equilibrium. The equilibrium is controlled by the conserved quantities in the box, the conserved energy, momentum, and number. And that will govern the density matrix that represents the effect of equilibrium. However, if we look at a smaller region in the box, we divide the box up into little boxes and look at a smaller region, what will typically happen is on a shorter time scale, those regions will approach local equilibrium, characterized by temperatures in the little volumes, by numbers in the little volumes, energy densities in the little volumes, and so forth, characterized by these quantities. And the rest of the approach to equilibrium can then be characterized by closed phenomenological equations of motion, which with the constituent relations, as they were called in my textbooks, like pressure versus density, determined by the local equilibrium in the volumes. So why energy, momentum, and volumes? Well, because these are the slowest variables in the system. Because they're conserved at large, they also approach, they're maintained, they approach equilibrium slower, and therefore you can describe classical behavior in terms of them better. And those are the variables that are characterize the quasi-classical realm generally, the integrals of densities of approximately conserved quantities. Notice that that doesn't have anything to say about the microscopic structure of the system. I mean, I talked about particles, but I didn't have to. Yes, please.
If I think of all the particles in one corner of the box, then there will be no local equilibrium until there's also...
Well, it takes a time scale for it to approach local equilibrium. So the idea is eventually you'll have little regions of the box
they will approach the local equilibrium, and then you can describe the rest of the approach to equilibrium, evening out, and so forth, by hydrodynamic equations. We're right now approaching equilibrium. Right? We're in a little box. Right? Right. But we can describe the inside of the box, right? We averaged over everything in terms of quantities preferred only in our little box. The temperature in the air, for example. But eventually we'll come into, over the recorded time, we'll come into equilibrium with the air in whatever we have, and so forth, et cetera. Right. Another question over here? Okay,
so that suggests what the variables are. So we look for classical behavior and expected values of approximately conserved quantities. And the key thing about the local equilibrium is that it assures that there are a set of equations of motion which close. And I'd now like to explain that. So here's, for example, let's suppose we label each of these little volumes by y. We're talking about volumes of a given. But each has the same volume V, and we take the energy density in the volume, and then we integrate over that x. That gives us a set of discrete variables for energy, momentum, and number. If we were in complete equilibrium, it's probably familiar to you that this would be described by a density matrix, which is e to the minus 1 over kt times the Hamiltonian minus the velocity of the box times the momentum minus the chemical potential times the number. Local equilibrium is essentially, which is determined by, it means that we have some density matrix for which this, right, the same thing, the expectations can be computed, of course, either from the fundamental row or from a local equilibrium density matrix, which is the same thing, but just summed over volumes. It's the temperature at x multiplied by the energy density x, the velocity of the fluid at x times the momentum density at x and the chemical potential at x times nu of x. These quantities, temperature, velocity, and chemical potential, can be expressed in terms of the energy densities, momenta, and number just by these relations. In principle, you could calculate there. You know what this expectation value is. Stick that in there. Calculate it in terms, calculate what beta, all these quantities are in terms of epsilon and the other one. There are two very different timescales, once again, the local equilibrium timescale. So now we can talk about equations of motion. Classical equations, you can take the conservation laws, which again don't refer to the microscopic structure, but refer to the overall structure. So here's, for example, the equation of motion for the momentum density, and take the expected values of them. You get the derivative of the expected value with respect to time. Is minus the derivative of the stress, right? Same with the energy density, same with the number if there's a number current. The fact that these expectation values can be, these are just operators, the expectation values can themselves be expressed in terms of energy, these quantities, the temperature, the velocity, and so forth can be expressed in terms of the energy and momentum, which are the quantities you're taking the derivatives of, right, means that the equations close. So you actually have a system. People tend to talk about classicality without worrying about whether the equations actually close. This is why they close. This is because they're dealing with conserved quantities for which we have an equation of motion at a macroscopic scale. Typically, these don't give you the lovely, familiar equations that we like, right, because further assumptions are usually used. For example, the Navier-Stokes equations, which are in some sense basically, that's it for classical physics without fields. You assume that the stress energy has the most general possible form that you can write down, which is linear in the velocities, right, and not quadratic in the velocities. Then these quantities, pressure, and the relations between, say, pressure and number density, the two kinds of viscosities, are all calculable in terms of the local equilibrium that exists there, again, in terms of these quantities, which is why they close. So you can do a little, if you want to discuss the evolution of some complicated system, you can do a little experiments about the matter, looking at its local equilibrium, right, values, and you determine the constituent relations, and then you get classical physics.
Well, if we have histories of expectation values, right, or we, at least we have equations of motion for expected values, the approximate conservation allows the decoherence while preserving the predictability, because the conserved quantities tend to predict. You have to pick the volumes that are involved large enough to give enough force gradient to ensure decoherence, right? And beyond that, they have to be large enough to ensure the inertia that allows the variables characterizing the volumes to be predictable in the face of the noise that the typical mechanisms of decoherence. But you also have to pick them small enough to allow local equilibrium. If you pick the whole box, right, then it'll take just as long as the equilibrium time. And so the quasi-classical, there's a notion of the maximally refined quasi-classical rump, a rough notion, not an exact notion, which is you pick the volumes large enough to do this and as small as possible to allow that. And that's the quasi-classical realm stretching over the whole universe. And as shown by Howell and Brun, I won't go into it, the story for the expectation values can be promoted to a discussion of the classical correlations and high probability for classical correlations of histories. So here's the origin of the quasi-classical realm, a little schematic. We begin at the beginning with the quantum gravitational fog, right? From the quantum gravitational fog, there emerges classical spacetime. And once you have classical spacetime, then you have local Lorentz symmetries. Once you have local Lorentz symmetries, then you have conserved quantities, right, which follow from those symmetries. The approximate conservation implies these quasi-classical variables are predicted, despite the noise from decoherence, and local equilibrium implies closed sets of equations of motion. So where are we now? Well, we've got histories, at least I claim we did. We're certainly dealing with, we're not dealing with isolated subsystems, but something. We've now sort of seen how to do it when we're not connected to the fundamental equations, because the conservation laws of wire is only from symmetries, right? And we have those symmetries on large enough scales. And notice we didn't posit exactly the variable x. It's too much to say that we derived it, but we gave an argument for why these particular variables should persist in the face of the mechanisms of noise. But we still didn't derive classical spacetime. I'm going to come back to classical spacetime if there's time, right? But I'm going to make a few. Yeah. What?
Yeah. Maybe I make it. I'm not sure. Let's see. I want to make a few comments first of all. People always ask the question, well,
okay, if that's quasi-classical domains are just one, why don't we focus on it? The answer to this question, to answer any question that involves we, right, you have to say what we is in a certain physical description, if we're talking about physics. We don't exist out there in the universe somehow independent of our classical description. All those descriptions, as far as I know, involve quasi-classical variables. I don't know of a description of you in other variables or even any other type of ligases in other variables. For most of our history, we focused on quasi-classical variables. So the simple answer to why we focus on them is evolution has equipped us with apparatus that's sensitive to quasi-classical variables. It's the way we observe what we observe because we are what we are, right? That's not a very profound argument. But with quantum mechanics, we've actually gotten beyond that a little bit, and we've now evolved to measure a few non-quasi-classical variables, not very many. And in principle, alternative evolutionary outcomes are in principle calculable in quantum mechanics. I mean, if you ask, what's the probability we had five fingers? One can imagine doing a calculation which is a definition of we, which would permit five, six, seven, or eight fingers. They could try and calculate that. I have no idea how to do that. But in principle, that's the sort of alternatives in histories. But as far as I know, there's no interpretation of we that doesn't involve some quasi-classical description. And that's basically the origin of our focus on. Here's a little science fiction story. This is the story of the inhabitants of the planet Zargon, right, who've been studying decoherent histories for 50,000 years. And they decide to clone their identities. Not, they're not doing quantum cloning because their identities don't involve into qubits of a topological qubits, so which will resist decoherence and then they'll be able to live forever. So they can be said, right, to have evolved to use more quasi-classical variables than most of us, But as is typical in science fiction stories, they forgot something, the Adrian Kent set selection principle, which showed there wasn't any other variables, and so that was the end of that.
Captain Kirk, by the way, encountered a lot of this stuff all the
time. Typically, going into those other variables produced nasty behavior, as far as I could say, which had to be corrected, right? Okay. Well, we were supposed to also derive Copenhagen quantum mechanics. That's a sort of triviality once you have the quasi-classical domain. Measurement is an interaction between an otherwise isolated subsystem, the system, and another, the apparatus, resulting in a correlation between the system variable and a quasi-classical variable of the apparatus, which we've now defined. Decoherence, well, histories of measured alternatives decohere since they are correlated with decohering quasi-classical histories of the apparatus. So we recover the usual Copenhagen rule that you can assign probabilities to histories of measurements because they're correlated with things which decohere in the larger universe. In highly idealized models where the probabilities of sequences of measurements can be approximately expressed in terms of the histories of the system, can be expressed in terms of projections on the system alone, that's extremely important because we go thereby from 10 to the 80th particles in the visible universe down to one, say, if we're talking about the history of a given electron. So it shouldn't be minimized. So the approximate quantum mechanics of measured subsystems, which is what I would like to call the Copenhagen quantum mechanics, Copenhagen quantum mechanics is not orthogonal to decoherent histories. It's contained within it, right? Okay, enough about that. I want to mention one other feature of the universe, which is also connected with the quasi-classical realm, which is the second law of thermodynamics. The universe, as far as we can tell, exhibits a tendency, first of all, the total entropy to increase, and also what I would call the homogeneity of the thermodynamic arrow of time. Every system moves towards equilibrium. That's statistics, right? But it's a fact in our universe that most presently isolated systems are all evolving towards equilibrium in the same direction of time. Not all of them, because there are refrigerators around, but most of them are going in the same direction. Those two things together, I think, are what we would properly call the second law of thermodynamics. These features are connected with the quasi-classical realm and the coarse graining that defines it, but they require further restrictions on the initial quantum state, which is connected with what's needed for quasi-classical spacetime, but not exactly the same. First of all, the approach to equilibrium is described by thermodynamic entropy, and what is that entropy? Well, in any coarse graining, information has to be sacrificed for decoherence in order to get predictability. I hope I've illustrated that enough. The entropy that's involved in the second law is the measure of that missing information when we're using quasi-classical variables. So according to the Jane's prescription, it's the maximum of the entropy functional over rho twiddles, which preserve the expected values of the quasi-classical coarse graining. Thus, it's the same coarse graining that defines the quasi-classical behavior as defines the second law in with the usual entropy of chemistry and physics. In order to have the second law, we have to have further conditions on the initial state. The second law is explained, as Boltzmann explained 100 years ago, right, by the fact that if the initial state is such that the initial entropy is near the minimum it could have for that coarse graining, right, then it has nowhere to go but up. And that's the second law. We also need a further thing, right, which is that the relaxation time, the equilibrium, is long compared to the present age of the universe, so that the general tendency to increase will dominate its evolution. We don't want to be in a situation where we're already in equilibrium, right, a total equilibrium at the time, then we wouldn't have classical behavior, and we wouldn't have a second law either. So both of these are necessary. The no boundary state of Stephen Hawking satisfies the first of these, and approximate conservation of quasi-classical variables helps with the second because it means that the entropy defining local equilibrium varies slowly and has enough time to exhibit. So where are we now? Well, we're still back where we started. I just had this excursion, and the last problem is explaining classical spacetime. The key to explaining classical spacetime is not conserved quantities, as far as I can tell, right? Because in general relativity, there are no conserved quantities. They can only be traced to the initial quantum state of the universe. So it's the quantum state of the universe that is key to the origin of classical spacetime. And Hawking's no-boundary quantum state does imply classical spacetime, which is, those of us who participated in that thought was one of its great triumphs. Rather crudely, it's true, but nonetheless. But quantum space, to deal with quantum spacetime, requires a further generalization of quantum mechanics. That was my talk in Oxford, so there's no need to repeat it here. Well, maybe I'll just give a very brief summary of it, of it here. The reason quantum mechanics needs to be generalized further is familiar quantum mechanics assumes that there's a fixed spacetime. It needs that just to define the T in the Schrodinger equation. It needs that to define the space-like surfaces on which the wave function is reduced or measurements are carried out, or which or alternatives are defined in decoherent histories. These projections are at some time. But in quantum gravity, space-time is fluctuating and without definite value. So on a given manifold, we might have two points in one geometry that are time-like separated and two points that are space-like separated in another geometry. Roughly speaking, we're supposed to sum over these. So where's the T going to be in the Schrodinger equation? T comes from is a classical space-time notion. Well, you can generalize quantum mechanics. I'll just describe two facts. The key idea about histories is that histories don't have to describe evolution in space-time, but they can describe the evolution of space-time. So here's, for example, an example of the problem I'm working on right now. Every assertion that can be made about the universe corresponds to a partition of those fine-grained histories, which are space-time plus matter fields. So I'm working with Thomas Hertog and Stephen on trying to calculate the probability that the universe bounced in early epoch. What does that mean? What are the alternatives? Well, we divide the set of all possible cosmological histories up into ones which exhibited a bounce, like the Sitter space, and ones which were initially singular. And then we try to calculate the probabilities of those that coarse graining of histories in a completely four-dimensional sense without introducing a notion of time. You can write down, at least formally, right, one of these four-dimensional generalizations. So the fine-grained histories are four-dimensional histories of space-time geometry and matter fields. The coarse grains are partitions of these, and the coarse grain in the four-dimensional diffeomorphism in invariant classes, as I've just illustrated. Whether the universe bounced or not is a diffeomorphism invariant statement. The measure of interference between them, that is the decoherence functional, can be constructed by four-dimensional sums over histories. The interesting thing from the point of view of Everett is there is no 3 plus 1 formulation in general, no notion of states evolving through time. Fotini.
The first and the second?
Okay. I'll come back to this. The answer is not yet.
Is that the
way it is? Yeah, well, I'll be answered right now. I mean, finding diffeomorphism in invariant partitions is quite a challenge, right? It's a challenge even in ordinary mathematics. In what sense is a round sphere close to the surface of an arch? Well, it's intuitively plausible, right, that they're close together. But what's the diffeomorphism and non-embedding sort of statement of that fact that they're close? That's quite a hard problem, even in mathematics, coarse grain. And it's a hard problem in classical cosmology, which has never been solved. That is, we approximate the universe by homogeneous and isotropic Friedman reference and Walker models. But the local universe is full of singularities that are quite large deviations. Well, we say, well, we averaged over. But what is the average? Nobody knows precisely even how to solve that problem. You can do it, however, on lattices, and then presumably you can do it on spin points, right? In the discrete approaches. So you can do it in Reggie calculus, for example. But it's among the problems I'll mention later as things that have to be solved. So classical space-time is predicted for states where the probability is high for decoherent histories exhibiting patterns of classical correlation corresponding to the Einstein equation. Okay, so we have a lot to do left in this subject. First of all, I've given much more quantitative than this, usually in this series of lectures, but we need still more detailed quantitative and realistic calculations of quasi-classical realms. There are decoherence, noise, probabilities, and more realistic initial states. We also, I think, lack the intuition, right, which enabled us to avoid those calculations. That's what we did. Most of what's been done so far is very laborious calculations, lots of oscillator models. You'd think we would have been able to sort of see through all that, but it turns out to be elusive. We need more realistic coarse grains, corresponds to narratives that are branch dependent in the sense that the probabilities are maximally refined in different areas, for example, of the universe, depending on what happened earlier. And we need a comparison to quasi-classical realms with other realms. Our universe might be exhibit information theoretic measures which would allow us to say, for example, whether the quasi-classical realm is the simplest and most predictable of these. And finally, here's your question for the diffeomorphism in variant coarse grains of space-time geometry and the mechanisms for their decoherence. Sort of deserved gold stars, and now it got a little fluffy toward the end. Ever showed us how the quantum mechanics of the universe could help us understand the quantum mechanics in the laboratory. Sigmund Freud showed how neglected, seemingly trivial everyday phenomena, such as dreams, lapses, and so forth, could shed light on the fundamentals of psychology. Quantum cosmologists should do no less with their trivial everyday phenomena, such as classical space-time, finding of four dimensions, quasi-classical realm, the laws of thermodynamics, the hours of time, the distinction between past, present, and future. Thank you very much.
There's a couple of some related arguments, some plausibility arguments by Deutsch and some rather more detailed arguments by Wojciech and Dinko workers that suggest that inside the environment-induced framework, the classical chaotic systems tend to go indeterministic.
Mm-hmm.
I take it that's not problematic for the framework to say. You just generalize the framework equations.
Yeah, so once again, I was defining that role. As far as the environment goes, those boxes define the environment themselves. What you're looking at, it's not like a separate positive environment. For every coarse grain, there's always an environment at one time, but it may change in time. But those boxes, once you've made a statement about what's ignored, you're defined with this environment. That's what's ignored.
Yeah, and what I was thinking of was more that the local equilibrium equations might turn out to be stochastic rather than deterministic. That's usually what's problem.
I don't think so. Todd Friend did some work on that, right, which was, we investigated chaotic systems in this framework a long time ago.
Matt?
You objected when we had done these polls that the coherent consistent history wasn't, in your view, correctly put into any of the alternatives there. So I would be very curious to hear how you would prefer to articulate how coherent consistent history is related to other interpretations, whether it is in some sense to be thought of as many worlds with maybe some more machinery on top, or...
Oh, I forgot to mention while I was saying that I was not a positive probability rule, but I also didn't have to take a stance on whether all the worlds were equally real or not real as far as the particular population.
But since you objected, I'm curious what you suggest to do instead.
Mostly I objected to your characterization with and without collapse. The history
of... I wouldn't leave you room for you and Griffith.
Well,
but
the history is a very good
account. And then you also did say in this talk here that, in some sense, the Copenhagen interpretation comes from within.
It's contained. Right, so it's not the same. But you had Copenhagen and Decoherent in the same. On the same lines. That actually was not a problem. It's these series of projections here. The projections act like collapse in a formal sense. Do they mean collapse? I don't know. You have to tell me what you mean by collapse. They're not associated with measurements. They're merely operators which describe the histories. Right? There's certainly nothing mysterious about them as there is for the law of. For example, there's no measurement problem in this way of formulating theory. In the sense, we have two notions of evolution. You could write a wave function as evolve, project, evolve, project, evolve, project, but you could equally well leave the projections out. Right? They're just what you use to describe the history. So I didn't know how to answer whether it was, I forget what it was. Right?
So I apologize.
Decoherent histories with collapse or decoherent histories without collapse?
So I apologize if I phrased my
question. It's got projections, that's what I would like. Okay. Decoherent histories with projections, yes. Decoherent histories without projections, no.
So let me sharpen my question. Do you or do you not feel that we should view decoherent histories as its own interpretation? In the same, if we're going to put it in the list together, Bohm, Model, Copenhagen, as a separate alternative to these, or do you feel that's unfair?
Let me deal with those one at a time. Model, I actually don't know what it is. So that's easy. Right. You're going to tell me what it is. Somehow you're the representative of mobile bomb mechanics here. I don't know if it's made a mistake of writing a couple of papers. I don't think like that. I've had as my frequentest derivation of probability. Bohm is not exactly an interpretation. It gives probabilities for histories which are different from decoherent histories. Therefore, it makes different predictions. But it makes the same predictions for a common set of alternatives at one time. And therefore, it's extremely difficult to distinguish experimentally. In Bohm, for example, it looks to me like it's going to be extremely difficult to do cosmology in Bohm. And the reason has to do with these surreal trajectories that occur when you have superpositions of wave packets. So we see the situation in Bohm where the past in the quantum trajectories is deterministic, but highly non-classical. Now, as a cosmologist, you would know that if we would get nowhere, right, in cosmology today, if we didn't just assume that we could extrapolate everything back completely classical. So Bohm might not allow you to do that. I haven't shown that, but I showed you simple two-dimensional models of that folks, building on this work of a long series of people who think Anguera or Brown, I forget, who did these examples. I could illustrate for you, but I'm not sure. Maybe I'll look afterwards, right? It's a very simple idea. Anyway, it might not give you the right histories in cosmology. But it's distinct, therefore it's distinct, right? But it's hard to distinguish experimentally. It's sort of intermediate category. What I mean by an interpretation, right, quantum mechanics, is something which makes exactly the same predictions for things which make exactly the same predictions for measure.
So
Bohm is a different interpretation.
So when you say that consistent history is a different interpretation from Copenhagen and also different from any world?
No, Copenhagen is contained within consistent history.
But the Copenhagenists would say that there is a collapse. It's explicit. It's impossible. And you're saying we should be there.
From those projections, that you can now start to analyze measurements. Right? And you can ask whether, if you try to formulate the information evolution in terms of the subsystem, right, whether those projections are represented by projections on the subsystem. The answer is almost never. But for things like blinking atoms and so forth, they are so represented, and so you could talk about collapse. But those projections inherit their, I'd like to use some long philosophical word, but I don't know what it is. Their status are projections that have nothing to do with measurements, and therefore I don't see a problem.
So to summarize, it's different from any world, but it's in the same camp as Copenhagen then.
Well, also it's different from many worlds either. Many worlds has an additional statement. It's the same stuff, right? With an additional statement that the other worlds are real and no probabilities to start out by understanding from this world.
Actually, we move on to that's another thing.
So you emphasize the importance of conserved quantities in case we're getting
classical. That's it. Therefore, space-time symmetries, therefore, space classical.
Great. But then you said that I can't actually use it because in GR I don't have symmetries.
So the problem with writing, if you're a classical spacetime, then we can derive the rest of the quasi-classical realm. Deriving classical spacetime is something that has to be done, as far as I can tell, not from symmetries, not from, has to be done directly from the initial condition. It's a much bigger constraint on the initial condition.
So let me clarify this. If I'm not particularly ambitious, and what I want to get is the world we live in, which is an FRW,
yeah.
How do I do this?
Well, it depends on what your planetary gravity is. I should be asking you this question. You're the expert on that. I think it's a trickier problem in general, and therefore it's a bigger constraint. And so when people present on the string landscape, they're always worried about any predictions and how to distinguish them. The first thing that they should be looking at is whether it predicts classical spacetime, so they're as follows. In this work with Hertog and Hawking, right, in simple mini superspace models, we show some surprising features in this no boundary wave function. Right, in this class of models, you don't just get automatic classical behavior every time, for example, it requires a certain amount of matter to have classical spacetime, both of the matter and the geometry. I wouldn't say we fully understand it, but that's the result of the numerical calculation. So you can have pure de Sitter space, you can have a vacuum evolving, where we don't live, but little perturbations in de Sitter space in a certain range of the parameters, no, it has to be a sufficiently big perturbation.
So there's a technical issue that comes up in connection with
Fermi.
Is that your answer?
Yeah.
I don't bother with the question.
Let me ask if it's an adequate answer. Is it an adequate answer?
Well, it's not an unexpected answer, but I'm not sure. Let me state it, then people can decide. So in that formula that you've written there, in the middle of the slide, mm-hmm. on the right is something that could make sense for quantum gravity. On the left is something that doesn't obviously make sense. No, about one line above. The definition of this class operator, see? Because it involves P of T, Heisenberg, P of T, and so on. Mm-hmm. So we would like to, at least I would, many of us would like to take the right-hand side of the basic one. And there's a thing, history in alpha, so alpha is
meant to be. Oh, I see, right-hand side, you mean this. Well, we can sum over Fermi. It's not a problem.
Well, there's a sum of both, but then there's this alpha, which is a subset of the space of history.
So it partitions by currents.
Well, I'm not sure if we know how to do that. I mean, so there's the, what space is one dealing with? What is the space of currents? There's a formal space of Rossmann fields, but it's not actually a space which has global currents. It's not literally.
I worked this out once, but never published. So you integrate
them. If you had projection operators, you could put projections on the field. But I'm asking, is there a more fundamental way that wouldn't depend on this assumption of Hamiltonian Heisenberg picture and so on that could be used in connection with quantum gravity?
I think we got a couple.
Simon. In fact, just coming back to the question you asked with pushing, I think you feel neutral about. Quite hard to interpret it, right? It's an admission problem, not being specific enough. If you were to be so specific as to insist that only one history is real, then indeed you would have you would have wave packet reduction. And you'd have that reduction taking place at the sequence of times in which you'd originally coarse grained the history. And the natural question is be more precise, please. Which was always the question about the measurement process. The way the measurement process was just fine, except, well, let's have more precision, when exactly was the
end. Where's the end precision?
In what precisely is the coarse grain? Let's have the precise coarse grain.
For the quasi-classical variables, is that true?
Indeed. Specify the history space precisely. That would be the nature of the measurement problem. In your framework, if you insist on one of any one history.
Well, this is not
what precisely is.
Yeah, completely trivial question, but for starters, we can consider projections down on ranges of averages over little volumes of the conserved quantum.
Yeah, no, quite. But what precise average? I mean, I think the question is a silly question if one's saying all the histories are real. It becomes a non silly question if you say only one history. Because this is the universe. After all, well, let's have it. We didn't receive it.
I don't know.
Precisely, is the history of the universe.
Right. I don't have any solution.
Right, but that's the measurement problem in your framework, if you insist.
Oh, okay. If you say so. Well, these people are the experts on that.
Yeah, it's kind of the same thing, conceptually. I mean, okay, quick parable before the questions. The parable is two systems. They both think electromagnetism is the right theory. One of them says, and in addition, the electromagnetic field is real. Yeah. The other one avoids saying such philosophical stuff. Those people, there's not an interest. So, arguably, I don't know, there's not an interesting difference between those two guys that are talking about it's kind of like. So with the parable out of the way, I'll ask you to kind of the same framework I tried on my kind of point check. It seems to me that the framework you're adopting differs from the many worlds framework, as I don't know, ignoring the probability question for the minute. Only in one's willingness to attach words like real to certain bits. But otherwise, one's basically playing the same game in a way that you're not playing the same game as, say, Chris Foote, you're not playing the same game as Bavonian, and you're not playing the same game as Masters.
Yeah.
Is that fair?
That is fair. I came here expecting Simon promised to straighten me out. And somebody said he did. He said, you know, if you're going to say only one world that you said is real that lacks unity, something was going to say, wrong, but I forget. It seems to me that's a, what do we have philosophers for,
anyway? I mean, so I thought say, Neil Simon and Wojciech, and you and Wojciech, is actually just that you, our respective dictionaries have slightly different translation rules for words like real existence, and other than that, it seems to be.
I think it's the same thing. What I'm on record is saying, which I'm prepared to withdraw, is it doesn't make any difference for these calculations whether you say one thing or the other. One said one thing is a set, or whether you say the whole thing is really real. Therefore, you can say I am.
Okay, sounds like a good point to go for Chief.